Radio Show. My name is Brian Hanks. I'm the managing editor here at the Free Press in lovely and beautiful Kinston, North Carolina. His name, the producer, he's the musician, he's the magician, is John Dawson. How are you today?
I have a summer cold, so I'm on top of the world.
I'm sure you are. Listen, got a very, very special edition of the Free Press Radio Show for you here today. In fact, and this is going to make a lot of people smile too, John Dawson. You're not going to hear a lot from me over the next hour or so.
Well, we had to edit your cursing and bodily functions out.
Well, there's nothing wrong with that. Wait a minute. All of my bodily functions?
It took me 3 days to get them all out.
Very good. Tell you what, a very special guest coming up here in probably about a minute or so. You had a chance to interview Bill Schiff. He is not a name that a lot of people know until you realize all the stuff that he's done. We're going to talk about that here in a second. But first, how the hell do you get Bill Schiff to do a podcast in Kinston, North Carolina?
I'm not really sure still. I heard him. There was a syndicated radio show that used to be in this market called Bob and Tom that I really enjoyed. And of course, anything I start to enjoy, it goes out of the market and goes away. But he was on there, I don't want to say every week, but every so often he had a column with Sports Illustrated. And of course, he's been Letterman's monologue writer for 21 years or so. And he's a very funny guy, but he kept making this joke about. In the South, he would have his book signings at Barnes and Duh, which no Southerner has a chip on their shoulder about anything like that.
No, of course not.
But I used his name in my columns for a month or so just because I kept that Barnes and Duh joke kept bugging me. And he just emailed, 6 months later, he emailed me and he said, I don't know what I did to deserve all the credit here, but thanks.
Wow. So a pretty good attitude about
so
you.
So being a shyster, I pulled on that string and said, you want to do our little show we're putting together here in the basement? And he, for some reason, agreed to do it, and it was very cool to talk to him.
You know, when stuff like that happens, and you told me this whole story, and especially this interview that's coming up here in a couple of minutes that you did with him, it proves to me, and you are so cynical, John Dawson, but there are still good people out there.
Well, he's one amongst...
a dozen or so in the world?
Yeah.
There you go. Novelist, columnist, television writer, rock and roll drummer Bill Schiff made his bones as a touring stand-up comic during the 1980s. In 1991, he was hired as a monologue writer for David Letterman. I have heard of him before. Okay?
Yeah, he's been around a lot.
And it's a post that Bill still holds today. During his stint with the Letterman Show, Schiff has been nominated for 15 Emmy Awards. He's also written for... 2 Academy Awards broadcasts. He was a head writer for 3 ESPY Awards shows, has contributed special material to the Emmys, Tonys, and Grammys. He began his professional career as a sports writer for the Albany.
Yeah, I'm not going to edit that out.
There you go. The
Albany
Times Union, which is in upstate New York. Schiff has contributed material to the New Yorker, the New York Times, and Esquire, among many other publications. According to his website, which is www.billschiff.com, and that's let me just spell it out, BILLSCHEFT.com. He, quote, lives in Manhattan with his wife, comedian Adrienne Tolsch, and the voices in his head, close quote.
And irony of ironies, whenever I talk about Barnes and Noble now, I refer to it as Barnes and Duh. That's so I've come full circle.
From being offended to describing it the way he does. Well, listen, a very good interview coming up here with John Dawson and Bill Schiff.
Okay, well, I'm from Boston, Massachusetts originally, but I've been living in New York since 1980. And, been living in New York City. I lived in Albany for 2 years after I got out of college. When I was a sports writer, but that's
where did you go to college?
I went to I went to Harvard.
I'm
a graduate of Harvard College in 1979. I majored in Latin because I thought the church was going to come back, and here's where I am.
Well, you've got an interesting combination. Comedy and sports writing, and how did you first get into stand up? Like, who were, I guess the first question should be, who were your early comedic influences that made you say, well, you enjoyed it so much you wanted to go give it a stab? Who were your early favorites?
Well, I was a guy that you know, when I was 13 or 14, would stay up and watch The Tonight Show. I also would watch Ed Sullivan. So I loved Richard Pryor, and I loved George Carlin, like most people my age, most guys that became comics my age. I didn't discover Robert Klein till a little later, but, you know, I liked all the people that I like. You know, I liked Bill Cosby, but I think that the ones that that I really looked forward to seeing, the two were Pryor and Carlin. And then when I was 18, I discovered Lenny Bruce, and, you know, who really is the godfather of modern stand-up comedy. And he was so different, and I sought to learn a lot about him, and I really became fascinated. And then when I was 18, I went to a prep school called Deerfield Academy. And when I was 18, myself and about four other guys, we stole a faculty member's car one night, and we drove to a bar in Northampton called the Early Times. This is when it was legal to drink at 18. And I went on stage there. I did 7 minutes of stand-up, and let's say 5 minutes were I had borrowed from other people, and 2 minutes I had written myself. And,
now, had that been something you were plotting for a while?
No, alcohol inspired. Look, you know, most comics, I'm a cliche. I was a class clown. I was a guy that would do impressions of teachers. I was funny as a kid, and my family was funny, and, you know, I was. There's a great movie, well, it's not a great movie, but it's a very insightful movie called Mr. Saturday Night, with Billy Crystal plays this old-time comic, and his brother is his manager. And his brother is just as funny as him. But he says to his brother, you know, you just had living room balls. You know, you could only really perform in the living room. You really couldn't perform. And so I was like a living room guy, and then I just wanted to go on stage and try it. I wish I knew whose line this was, but somebody once said that somebody becomes a stand-up comic the way a woman becomes a hooker. You know, you do it for one person, and then you do it for a few close friends, and then you realize you're good enough at it to get paid. And that was my path. And from the ages of 18 to 22, I probably went on stage two or three times a year. When I was a junior at Harvard, I won an undergraduate talent show doing stand-up. And I knew how to, I could kind of write jokes. I knew how to write jokes. I knew what they sounded like. And, you know, it was like a hobby for me. I never thought I was going to do it as a career. And then I was in Albany. I was a sports writer. And, you know, again, I was like the funny guy in the office, again, like the cliche. And a club, about 2 months before I left Albany, a club opened up in a suburb of Albany called Latham. And a guy at the paper, the newspaper, said, you know, they have all kinds of acts. They have comic. They have guys doing comedy. You should go down there. And I went down, and they said to me, well, look, yeah, we'll put you on. We can't pay you, but we'll give you Mexican food. And that was it for me. So I was there like three, four times a week, and I started writing an act. And, you know, I was just a guy that worked for food. And then I left the newspaper, and there was a rumor when I left the newspaper that I was going to move to New York City to become a stand-up comic. And I said, well, you got that half right. I'm going to move to New York, but I'm not going to become a comic. I'm going to be a freelance sports writer. And I was in New York for a little while, and I realized I'm not going to be able to. I can't make a living as a freelance sports writer. I don't know how to do anything. So I might as well see if I can make a little money as a comic. And so I started auditioning at the showcase clubs. It took me a while to pass audition at a couple of them. And then it was 1981, and this is just dumb luck. This is when stand-up comedy, this was the beginning of the comedy boom. This is when clubs opened up all over the country. And all of a sudden, it was very plausible to make a living as a stand-up. And I just happened to be right at it, right in the middle of it. And I was And then I was lucky enough to become one of the MCs at Catch a Rising Star, which was the biggest comedy club in the country. And, you know, I replaced, as one of the house MCs, I replaced Bill Maher because he was one of the house MCs. And then he did The Tonight Show a couple of times, and then he had to go. He had to move to L.A., you know, where the, you know, where there was a lot of TV work. And that's essentially who I replaced. I was one of three house MCs. The other two, one was a woman named Adrienne Tulsh, very funny woman who became my wife, still working, still great, you know, wickedly funny, and the funniest person in this family. And the other was a guy named J.J. Wall, who became a producer and a writer out in L.A., and he was replaced. J.J. was replaced by my best friend Larry Amoros, who was just a hilarious comic, who's now another guy that writes. And that was it. And I was in the generation just after Jerry Seinfeld and Paul Reiser. I mean, they were established. You know, Seinfeld and Reiser and Larry Miller and Larry David. So I was in that generation after them. But they were still around the Showcase Club, so I grew up with those guys.
You mentioned Larry Miller. How is he doing? He heard it, from what I've read, he hit his head a month or so back.
He hit his head. I think he's doing better. I think he's still in the hospital. I mean, the last I heard of him was a couple of weeks ago, but I know he's not doing any worse. I mean, I think it's just that type of thing is a long haul.
Yeah. Because I'm addicted to his podcast, and I was really getting into it. And about 4 weeks after I got into it, he slipped and hit his head.
Yeah, Well, I'll tell you, after we get off here, I'll reach out to somebody out there, and if I find out anything, I'll let you know. But I knew that I know he was doing better, but it's so, you know, in something like that, it's so incremental. But
yeah.
Thanks for asking.
I mean, has he ever been in a bad mood over anything, or is that just his persona?
Oh, yeah. I saw him cold cock a guy one night outside a club in Boston when we were working together. Yeah.
Oh, man.
He's got, you know, Larry is got a little bit of, even though he's not Irish, he's got a little bit of an Irish temper in him.
When you were doing stand-up now, were you predominantly in New York City working all
over
the
country?
No,
I worked all over the country. I worked all over the country. I went to Australia three times. I went all over Canada, all over the United States. I worked, you know, I was one of those guys. I was one of those guys that was on the road 30 weeks a year. And I could have been on the road 50 weeks a year, but I wanted to be in New York and work at the clubs in New York and, you know, maybe have something else happen for me. And, but yeah, I worked, I did it for 13 years. And,
Did you ever play Charlie Goodnights in Raleigh?
Absolutely, absolutely. I was one of the first comics to. I played Charlie Goodnights in 1984. And what's the guy's like? Tom, what's his last name who ran it? Tommy Williams.
Yeah, that's right.
Tommy Williams ran that club. And my brother still lives in Raleigh. My brother lived in Chapel Hill for years and years and years. So my wife, she wasn't my wife then, my girlfriend, Adrienne Tulsh, she played Charlie Goodnights just after it opened. And she said, you got to get down here. This place is great. And I played it, I would say, maybe the second or third month it opened. Tremendous club. And then I came back probably about 3 years later. And then I really essentially, after I got the job at Letterman in 1991, I didn't go on the road anymore. So I played it twice. And, you know, it's so funny because, you know, at the Letterman show, we have these college interns, and there's three shifts during the year. So I always, whenever I'm, you know, whenever a new shift starts, as I meet each one, I introduce myself and I say, where are you in school? And then I tell them their school's mascot, like they don't know it already. So this is a few years ago, and there's a girl at the copy machine. I say, oh, how you doing? I'm Bill Sheft. I'm so-and-so. I said, where are you in school? She says, I'm at NC State. I said, oh, the Wolfpack. And she said, yeah. And I said, hey, have you ever gone to Charlie Goodnight's? And she said, oh, I go there all the time. It's one of my favorite places to go. I said, well, I used to work there. And she said to me, "Oh, when was the last time you were there?" And I looked at her, and it dawned on me that the last time I had been there was before she'd been born. So there was a club in Rocky Mount that I played. There was, I played a few places, a club in Charlotte that I played. And, I liked working down south. I liked working the south better than the Midwest.
Now, is the audience because, is more generous, or?
Well, here's the deal. Here's the deal. You know, I'm I'm Jewish, and when you go down south and you do jokes about being Jewish, the laughter of somebody who gets the joke and the laughter of someone who's laughing because they hate Jews sounds exactly the same. That's great. So if you do the same joke in the Midwest, they, you know, if they hate Jews, they don't tend to laugh. So, but that's the difference. But I used to work in Atlanta. I used to work clubs in Florida. I used to work clubs in South Carolina and Virginia. I played just about all over.
I have a spaghetti string thin connection to some people you worked with.
Okay.
I'm in a band, and we had a song picked for a movie called A Good Old Fashioned Orgy that was written by Gregory and Peter Hayek.
Yep.
What are those guys doing now? How long were they there?
I knew those guys. I've been at the Letterman Show since 1991, and I've taken, so that's 21 years, and I've taken two leaves of absences to finish novels or work on various projects. And I knew Peter and Alex. They were at the show, I want to say 2 years, not longer. And they were, we used to call them the frat boys, because they were so young when they started. And a lot of times writers start young, but they were young and they looked young. And they were very strong. I mean, usually when guys get hired, it takes you 6 months to find your way around or get your voice down. But these guys, they really hit the ground running. They were very impressive. They were good-looking guys, too. And, you know, they were just very confident and very strong. And so they lasted 2 years, and then they left. And then they worked on the last year of the Larry Sanders Show, which, of course, is one of the great shows ever. And right. then they would surface here and there. But and I don't know about Peter, but Alex has had a wonderful career as a cartoonist for The New Yorker. So that's what Alex has done, you know. And I'm sure he still writes. He does some script writing. But that's how I know Alex. And Peter, I don't know, but I do know about this movie. And but I haven't seen them in a lot. There's two teams that went from Letterman in the last few years that have just really done well. They were one, and the other ones, and oh, God, I'm so old, I can't remember these guys. But you know the show How I Met Your Mother? The two of them created that show. What the hell is their name? The two guys that created How I Met Your Mother. Oh, my God, this drives me crazy. Well, you'll look it up. But those two guys, they worked at the show. They worked at the show for about 3 years, but they were very strong. And then before them, at the beginning of the Letterman Show in the 80s, Tom Gammel and Max Pross, they worked at the show for a couple of years, and then they went on to have tremendous careers. I mean, they wrote for any major, major show, from Seinfeld to Newhart to, again, Larry Sanders to, I mean, any show that you've liked, they've written on, Tom and Max. Oh, Carter and Craig. Carter Bays and Craig, oh, this will drive me crazy, but Carter and Craig are the two guys that created How I Met Your Mother.
Yeah, that's done pretty well.
Oh, my God. I mean, that's, you know, that's one of those jobs. If you get a sitcom, if you're running a sitcom, and you hit episode 100, after that show ends, this is what your morning is. You wake up around 11, you make coffee, you read the paper, then at noon you go to the mailbox and you open it up and you pull out a stack of checks. And then, you know, and then it's the afternoon. That's your day if you create a show like that.
That's the goal, yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to talk about some of your other writing gigs. If you just want to give us an overview, you wrote for ESPN Magazine and for Sports Illustrated for a while.
Right. Well, I mean, when you... the idea was that I was going to be a sports writer. My uncle was a very famous sports writer. My uncle wrote for the New Yorker for years. His name was Herbert Warren Wind. He's the most famous golf writer this country has ever produced. He's the guy that coined the phrase Amen Corner. And so he was a big influence on me. So that was the idea. And then I started doing stand-up, and I kind of gave up that notion. I realized, okay, well, you're not going to be a sports writer. And then... 20 years after the fact, I had done a lot of work at ESPN. I was the head writer for the ESPYs for 3 years, and I did various things for ESPN over the years. And I get a call from ESPN Magazine in 1999, and Tony Kornheiser had a regular column, and he was leaving, and they were looking for a replacement. And they said, "Are you interested in doing a column?" And I went, "Are you kidding me?" I mean, I thought that this was some kind of racket. I didn't think they really wanted me, because Tony Kornheiser is a legitimate guy. So I came in and I met with them, and they said, "Do you have any ideas for a column?" And I said, "Yeah, I've always wanted to do a column called The Monologue, where it's just, because that's what I do for Dave, it's just topical jokes about sports, and I string them together." And they said, "Well, that sounds really tough. I mean, we come out every 2 weeks. It would be 800 words. That's 30, you know." And I said, "Well, that's 30 jokes." And they said, "You can write 30 jokes every 2 weeks?" I said, "I write 60 a day for Dave. You know, none of them get on, but I write 60 a day."
Plenty left over, yeah.
So they hired me, and I had the job there. I worked there for 2 years. It was so great. And then I got hired away by Sports Illustrated to do it weekly, to do the same column weekly. I changed the name to The Show. And I was at Sports Illustrated for 3 years, and it was the most perfect marriage of my three careers, because it was the perfect marriage of sports writing, stand-up comedy, and writing for The Letterman Show. And I loved it. I really loved it. And I had a big following, and it was great. It was great for me.
Wanted to mention The Ringer, and... That was a very popular book. And did anything ever happen with the screen adaptation?
Never say never. You know, everybody, every once in a while, somebody pokes their head and is interested. And this takes a long time for novels. Do you remember the movie Thank You for Smoking? Well,
yes.
That was a Christopher Buckley novel. That took 17 years. You know, it's optioned, it's not optioned. So The Ringer, I really believe that one day it will be made into a movie. Now, meanwhile, my last novel, Everything Hurts, that is being made into a movie, and they're going to start shooting next spring with Paul Rudd in the lead, so I'm very excited about that. So that's...
Congratulations.
But The Ringer, look, I think... That I've gotten better as a novelist over the years, but The Ringer will always be my favorite novel because it was my first, and because my uncle, there was a major character was based on my uncle, so it will always be the nearest and dearest thing to my heart.
I'm glad Everything Hurts is being made into a movie, because I thought it could make a really great show on cable. But, you know, you'll take a movie, I'm sure.
Well, you know, it's funny because ABC was interested in Everything Hurts as a series a couple years ago. I had a couple of meetings, and you know, this is the thing about television, is that everybody gets all excited, you know, for like a weekend. and then they go away. And if they don't go away, you know, you end up having something done. But they get all excited, and you know, you act like, you know, your life is going to change, and then it's like, you know, we just. The thing about it is, I'm kind of glad it didn't happen, because to make that book into a series, you really would have had to create a completely different backstory. I mean, we did. You know, I did with the guy, you know, so we would have a pitch to the network. But it really didn't resemble the book at all. And I think the movie will be much more faithful. I hope so. I trust the people that are doing it, because the people that are doing it made My Idiot Brother with Paul Rudd. And I thought that was a very literary-type movie. I thought that was just the kind of thing that I go to see in a movie. You know, I like to see... I don't want to see explosions. I like to see people behaving for 2 hours. Yeah. So I have great confidence in the people that are doing this, and I hope, to me, I hope it gets made, I hope it gets sold, I hope it comes out, I hope it's a big hit, because to me, then it's just going to be a 2-hour advertisement for the novel, and that's what I care about. But that's a long way away. I mean, here we are, it's August.
Earlier you mentioned Lenny Bruce, and there was a comic I wanted to ask you about, because he had kind of a storied history with the Letterman show. I was always a fan of Bill Hicks.
My wife and I have a unique relationship with Bill Hicks.
Okay.
In the Bill Hicks story, and I would be happy to talk about him.
Sure.
My wife got Bill Hicks on the old Letterman show. Don't believe anything you've heard from anybody else. Don't believe Jay, because Jay likes to make things up. Don't believe anybody. My wife, Adrienne Tulsh, got Bill Hicks on the old Letterman show. Here's what happened. She used to play Houston a lot, the great club, the Laugh Stop down there. And that's where, you know, Hicks was based. And I had seen Hicks at a club in Atlanta, and I thought he was great, but it never occurred to me, you know, this is what makes my wife different from me. I never thought, oh yeah, he should be on Letterman. So she worked with Hicks in Houston and said, you need to come up to New York, because if you do, I'll get the Letterman people in to see you and you'll get the show. So Hicks comes up like a month later, and my wife gets Robert Morton, the producer, in. And, you know, to get these shows, it's a big process if you're unknown. They have to see you a few times. Well, it wasn't like that then. Robert Morton came in, saw Hicks, gave him the show. That night, saw him once, gave him the show. And that was, you know, and then also, and I used to tease Hicks about this, he comes up to New York for the first time. He gets the Letterman show, and then he picks up this gorgeous female comic. I mean, he had like the greatest weekend that anybody ever had, that any comic ever had. And he got the Letterman show, and he got laid, and so that began his relationship with the Letterman show. And he and I became pretty good friends. He moved to New York, and I used to open for him at some of the clubs, some of the showcase clubs, and I also did the intro on his first album, and you know, he and I, you know, we were nice friends. We liked each other a lot, and so he used to do the Letterman show regularly. So now the show goes to CBS, and it's our fifth week on the air. And Hicks was not the first comic we had on the show, but I think he was the third. I think Stephen Wright was the first. I think we had somebody, and then Hicks. So, and Hicks was, like I said, he was one of Dave's favorite comics on the old show. He did the old show like 11 times. And they didn't have many comics on the old Letterman show. They just didn't. So I see him backstage before the show, and he looks different. There's no leather jacket, there's no t-shirts, you know, he's shaved, he's got like a tweed jacket on. And I say, what's this? He said, oh, this is the new friendlier Bill Hicks. And I thought, oh, okay, fine, this will be interesting. And then he comes out, and he did a set, and the front of it was pretty strong, and the back of it was the type of material was, you know, I don't think he made the best choices, let's say, and I don't think
was that the Jackie Onassis joke, was that in there?
It wasn't so much, I'm not going to talk about, you know, the topic so much as it sort of wavered into the kind of a little, it was a little more speechifying than jokes, you know, which is where he went at the end of his career. So, I think that he and the segment producer didn't put together the best set. Okay, so fine. So, but he does well, and he sits down and he talks to Dave, and Dave says to him, "Hey, good luck answering your mail," because he did a lot of, he did some stuff about abortion, and he did some stuff about, you know, homosexuality, and that was what Dave said. And okay, fine. So now. And Dave was laughing during the set. So afterwards, I go backstage to say goodbye to him, and he says to me, "I'm going to be at Caroline's this week." And I said, "Oh, I'm going to." I said, "I'll come by." It was right down the street. And then the next thing I know, it was a Friday. I go up to say, you know, goodbye to Dave for the weekend, and. He said to me, "Don't forget to watch the show tonight," and which he never says to me. And I say to him, because I used to do the audience warm-up, so I say to him, "Oh God, was I caught on camera?" And he starts laughing. And I figure, oh my God, they caught me on camera. Okay, so now I go home, I turn the show on, and instead of Hicks, they've cut in a stand-up segment that I had done on one of the Shakedown shows before we went on the air. So my segment was cut in for Hicks, a stand-up segment. And it was one of the last stand-up things I ever did. And so, of course, you know how this story ends. A couple of months later, he's dead. And nobody knew about it. And... you know, they had told him, "Look, we had to do this," and people weren't as forthcoming as they should have been. But they also said to him, "But we definitely want you to come back. We definitely want you to come back." And nobody knew how sick he was. And so it kind of ended, you know, it ended just as badly as it, or as oddly as it could have ended. But then, as things happened, I think it was a few years ago. I don't know how long ago it was. He had his mother on, and he showed the set, and he said, "You know, I was wrong," and it was really moving. And I went up to his mother afterwards, and I said, "Hi, I'm Bill Sheff." She says, "I know who you are." And she said, "You know, my son was very fond of you, and he was happy for you." Well, I mean, you know, can you believe how much presence can a woman have? I mean, to say that her son's dead, you know, here's the guy who got cut in. And so that was a very emotional day for me. But and it was just a whole. So that's the story. That's you know, I know people are going to rewrite his story, but I was there and I'm telling you that this is what happened.
Well, I'm glad you told that story, because I had heard Leno, and some, I guess it was an interview, may have been a print interview, say that he got him on Letterman because he was too strong for the Tonight Show, and that just sounded odd to me.
But
and
you know, that's
know if
Jay.
I could ask you
Jay,
about it,
Jay's going to take credit for everything. Jay, you know, whatever. Here's the thing about Jay: whatever you're doing is wrong. Whatever he's doing is right. And whatever turns out well is because of something he did. That's you know.
I wonder if he'll be giving out free cars to the people he had to lay off the letter with.
Yeah, yeah. How about that? How about that? That somehow that story was spun that Jay is a hero for taking a salary cut to $20 million, but yet 24 people are laid off. And I'll just tell you this right now, is that 2 years ago, we had salary cuts. Dave took a cut, and we had salary cuts at the Letterman show, and not one person was laid off. So, you know, that's the difference. That's the difference,
yeah.
Among other things. But
the Bill Hicks, I mean, Bill Hicks was his material was genius and his delivery was genius. But and I guess what put it over the it was always cool to me to hear those kind of words and that material coming, being delivered via an accent like I have.
So you know usually, something that's such a great yeah. that's such a great thing that you said. That's so. Yeah, you know, I never thought of it like that. And nobody, you know, a lot of Southern comics mm-hmm. and a lot of guys that work a lot down south can do good Southern accents and can make, you know, can make fun of it or can recreate it. But he was the best, Hicks. He had the best father. He had, you know, he could do... you know, the dumb Southern guy, he could do all kind of degrees of, yeah, that's, I never heard it put that way, but he was, the thing about Hicks, you know, he loved other comics, which is great, which is, which most comics are like that. Some comics, people we have previously mentioned, are not like that. But most comics love other comics. You know, and they love good comics. And Hicks was like that. And the other thing about Hicks, this is me personally, but I think other people felt this way about him. You know, there's different degrees of funny. But he, for me, he was get out of the business funny. That's the highest level of funny because he was so funny as a stand-up back then. I said, what the hell am I doing? What am I doing in this? You know, why am I saying that I'm a comic? This guy's a comic. I'm whatever it is I do. You know, there was a comic named Ron Zimmerman who used to do a great line in his act about Robert De Niro shooting and killing Anson Williams at a Hollywood party because Anson Williams said, oh, you're an actor just like me. And it's sort of the same thing with Hicks is that If he's a comic, then everybody else should have been called something else. But yeah, I just his commitment to his material. I can't think of too many people like him. Lewis Black has that kind of commitment to his material. Lewis Black has tremendous commitment to his material, and that's a great thing. You know.
Lewis Black's routine about bottled water is in my top 10. I don't know if you've ever heard that bit, but it's fantastic.
Oh, sure. No, there's a lot of bits that he's got so many. His thing about performing in front of Dick Cheney and his parents coming up to him after the thing. Don't you ever put that? You know, I mean, it's just. Now he's wonderful, and you know, but Hicks was he was a very sweet guy. He was and he was really funny, and I'm sorry that things ended in the chronology that they did because you know he was sick. And, you know, what had happened to him on the Letterman show was unfortunate. And, you know, it's not unlike Lenny Bruce reading his trial transcripts.
Yeah.
You know. So, at the end. So, it's a shame. But I think about him, and you know, I was very fond of him, and my wife was very fond of him.
I just wish he could have lived long enough to have had a shot at, like, a Curb Your Enthusiasm of his own, where he just kind of had free reign to be as Bill Hicks as he wanted to be.
You know, I don't, you know, but the thing is that he, see, here's the difference between him and Larry David, who's a really good friend of mine. Larry David was, if you were a stand-up, Larry David was a great stand-up. But Larry David was never going to be a guy that could do an hour in front of 5,000 people. So that's why Curb Your Enthusiasm is just so perfect for him. You know, it's the perfect extension of who he is. But I think that Hicks, you know, look at a guy like Chris Rock, another guy tremendously committed to his material, and I've known him since he was 18. I don't think Hicks would have been interested in a show like that. I think that he would have just been doing great things on stage. I don't think he would have been interested. Maybe. Mm-hmm. But there's two. Here's the thing about television. There's too many people involved. You know what I mean? So.
That's why I was bringing up Curb, because I'm assuming Larry gets to do pretty much. I'm assuming he runs the show.
Yeah, he does. But what I mean is that there's too many people that are asking you questions all day that you need to answer. And I don't think that a guy like Bill, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you're in charge, if you're running a show like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that, you know, Larry David would hate for me to say this about him.
Mm-hmm.
But in addition to being a great comic and a brilliant writer, he's a tremendous executive. You know? He's a tremendous... You know, all the great people that ran through Seinfeld, not the regular cast, but all the guest stars, he found all those people. You know, he was like the casting director for that show. So...
Mm.
I don't think, when I think about Bill Hicks and I think about the mind of Bill Hicks, it doesn't say to me that he would be good managing people, because there's too much going on,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I think that, but then again, you look at a show like Louis, which I haven't seen, but he has total autonomy of that show. And people are falling all over themselves about it. So what do I know? But I just like to think that Hicks would have been a guy just, you know, coming out with one tremendous hour special every year and just kicking everybody's ass. And maybe, you know, I know that he was moving towards music, more towards music later in his career, and maybe a little more of that, and so.
He would have probably been like Carlin, who about every three and a half years, Carlin comes out with a killer hour.
Right.
It was like Clockwork Faithful, you know.
Right, right. I don't think he would have had the patience to sit around and wait for people like you do in television. I just don't think he would have. I don't. I mean, and again, I'm as wrong as much as I'm right. But, so.
Would you mind retelling the first joke you wrote for Letterman?
Here's my story. And you know, I have a lot of people that write me, and they want to get started, and I always take great pains to tell them that I submitted to the Letterman show 5 times and was turned down 5 times, and I only got the job on my 6th submission. So, again, you know, it takes what it takes. So I had submitted 5 times. The show came on the air in 82, so I submitted in 84, 5, 6, 7, took 88 and 89 off, submitted in 90, And then that was it. I guess, you know, I felt like that they had clearly made their decision on me. And then my wife and I, my wife was a member of the Friars. We were at the Friars. And there's Robert Morton, who knew me as a comic and knew me as someone that had submitted to the show and was trying to get on the show as a comic. And I saw him at the Friars, and I said to him, "You got any openings?" And he says, "No, we don't really have any." He said, "But you know," he says, "Dave is always looking for jokes." He said, "Just write some jokes. Send some jokes in." And I thought, really? Because my submissions were these fully developed comedy pieces like they were doing on the show and desk pieces. You know, I always thought that he kind of threw away his monologue. It was only three jokes. It was so conversational, you felt like he was writing it backstage before he came on. It was very
ironic. And it was
ironic.
So short because of Carson, right?
Right, because of the dictum from Carson, "Don't be like us." But I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'll write him some jokes. So I was, again, my 13th year as a comic, so the work, I wasn't quite getting as much work. It wasn't as easy to get work as it used to be, and I was kind of noticing that. So I had tried to concentrate more on the writing, and I had written on a couple of shows short term. And one show was on the Ha Network. Before there was Comedy Central, there was the Comedy Network, the Comedy Channel, and the Ha Network. And they merged to form Comedy Central. And the Ha Network had a show, a strip show, a talk show, called After Drive. It was hosted by Dennis Leary, who was a friend of mine, and Billy Kimball. And so I wrote on that show, and then I wrote on a couple other shows. So I decide, well, I'm going to write, any schmuck can write 10 jokes. I'll write 10 jokes a day for a week. And then on Thursday, so I'm turning them in every day, I'm dropping them off at NBC. Thursday night, I get a call at 7 o'clock from Morton. And if you were a comic back then, Robert Morton never returned anybody's calls. He was notorious.
Mm-hmm.
Calls me at my house. Says, "Hey, Dave, did you joke tonight?" And the joke was, it was 1991, since October of 1991, Elizabeth Taylor just got married again. And the joke was, well, Elizabeth Taylor and her new husband, Larry Fortensky, had their first fight. It was over whether or not he should unpack. And, you know, that's when he was only doing three jokes. And then the next night, he did another joke of mine. So I said to Morton, what does this mean? He says, well, it turns out we're looking for a monologue writer. I said, well, what should I do? Should I write some more? He says, no, those 50 jokes, that's your submission. So wait, and, you know, we'll try and get you in to see Dave. So I went to Las Vegas with my wife. We were working at the Tropicana. And it was all I could do not to think about this, because this is a job that changes your life. I was also a degenerate gambler. So I really just couldn't keep my mind straight. And then I flew back on the red eye. And I went in to see Dave, and I got offered the job the next day. So October 21st, and I started on October 27th, 1991. That's my story.
We've talked about comedy and writing. Let's get down to the real deal. Let's talk about the truants.
I happen to have here. Well, let's just talk about. So the truants is my band, and I wrote a book. My second novel was called Time Won't Let Me. And it was based on, it was inspired by the true story of what happened to my older brother. My older brother went to Phillips Academy, prep school, where George W. Bush went, and a lot of famous people. In the mid, late 60s, he was in a band called The Rising Storm. And they used to play dances like every band back then. And they played, and their senior year in 1967... they recorded an album, and they made 500 copies of this album. And the album had mostly covers, but it also had five originals, which albums back then by garage bands never had originals.
Yeah, that was like a rock opera to a garage band.
Right, exactly. So they had five originals. Okay, so that's 1967. They make 500 copies. They sell them. Cut to 15 years later. It's 1982. There's an article in the Boston Phoenix. "Do you know where this band is? Their album is worth $5,000. My sister sees the album, sees the article, calls the guy that wrote the article, says, I'm Tom Scheff's sister. He was the drummer in the band. The guy says, oh, you need to get in touch with this collector. And they reunite the band, and their album's now worth, I don't know. However, back then it was 3,000, it's now worth 5,000. It's the most valuable album of that genre. And collectors pay a lot of money for it. And ever since then, collectors reunite the band because they still sound the same. They're all professional, they're not musicians. And, you know, people that collect records, they know the Rising Storm. And to the point where 3 years ago, they went to Europe, they opened for the Yardbirds, they played at a garage festival in London where they sold out and people standing in line to get... So they're this sort of... this cult, that album is like a cult favorite and very, very valuable. So that's the true story. So I decided that I was going to write a novel based on the story, but their story was a little too hopeful. So in my... in Time Won't Let Me, it's 30 years later, the album's worth $10,000, but these guys can't get out of their own way to reunite. And that was the premise of the book, and I named the band in the book The Truants. And I learned how to play drums watching my brother, and I was pretty good, and I would play, like if I was working on the road, and I would finish stand-up and I'd go into a club and there was a band playing, I might sit in for a couple of songs, but that was the extent of how much I played or whatever. So after my book came out, people would write me and they would say, I've been in bands for 20 years, this is the best book about a band I've ever read, and how many bands have you been in? And the truth was, I'd never been in a band. I just watched my brother and his band. And finally, I went to see a guy in his band, and they were a surf band. They were great. And they were playing a place called Otto Shrunkenhead downtown in Manhattan. And I said, the guy had read my book, and I said to him afterwards, I said, the only thing that would have made it better, I said, is if your drummer had died of a heart attack and you had needed a drummer. And he said, you play the drums? I said, yeah. And he said, well, you should join the studio, which is this musicians collective on 30th Street in New York. And you can play and meet other guys. And so I joined there like 5-6 years ago. Started playing a lot, met some people. But I got tired of going to jams and playing Neil Young, frankly. I mean, I don't want to play Neil Young. I want to play the stuff that I want to play. So yeah. 2.5 years ago, I decided to start a band. And I said, I put ads in Craigslist and I said, look, we're not going to play anything after 1967. It's all British Invasion and garage music. And if you need sheet music, don't bother. And I found a bunch of guys. And I'm telling you, I'm 55. I started this band when I was 53. It's the best thing I've ever done. I've loved it. It's so much fun. We got a gig in 2 weeks at the Red Lion, which is a famous club in down in Greenwich Village. And I happened to put together the set list this morning in anticipation of this interview. So I'll read you. You do two sets, an hour piece. So because it's British Invasion garage music, a set is like 23 songs, because every song is 2.5 minutes. So
right, that's long enough. Yeah.
Yeah. So here's the first set. The first set is I Feel Fine, Walking the Dog, Route 66, All My Lovin', Bad to Me by Billy J. Kramer, Hey Little Girl by the Syndicate of Sound, Perfidia by The Ventures. We don't do the big hits. We try to do the second and third tier hits. We do a medley with Kicks and Have Love Will Travel by the Sonics, California Sun. Then here's a medley, It's Gonna Be All Right by Jerry and the Pacemakers, into Runaway. Then Pictures of Matchstick Men, how about that, by Status Quo.
Can't beat
that. The Night Before, Money, It's All Over Now, Needles and Pins, Double Shot by the Swingin' Medallions, Peppermint Twist, we have a great new keyboard player, Peppermint Twist, Roll Over Beethoven, Till There Was You, and then a medley, Long Tall Sally into I'm Down. That's the first set. Pretty good, huh? Here's the second set. The second set is we open with Around and Around. Then we do Don't Bother Me. We do Youngblood. We do the Beatles version of Youngblood. We do Cry for a Shadow, the only instrumental the Beatles ever released. I'm a Loser, Stepping Out by the Raiders. Dizzy Miss Lizzy, Honey Don't. Then we do a medley, Little Sister into Shaken All Over, the Guess Who version. Then we do When You Walk Into the Room by the Searchers. Then Secret Agent Man, then Anytime at All. Green Onions, which we just added, Ticket to Ride, For Your Love, Dirty Water, Twist and Shout, Walk Away Renee, Good Lovin', The Last Time, and then another medley to close, New Orleans, into Come On Now by the Kinks. Come on, is that an evening?
That's like the Nuggets box set incarnate right here.
We have a YouTube channel, The Truants Live. It's got about 25 videos on there, so you can go look at us. And
when are we going to see The Truants on CBS?
Nah. I'll tell you one thing. I'll tell you what's, and this is just between you and me and your listeners, but one of these days I wouldn't mind Anton Figg, who's a tremendous guy, great. I wouldn't mind him getting just a little coughing fit in the middle of the show and me, just kind of sitting in just for a couple. That's all.
Well, if he was to have an unfortunate accident.
No, I don't want. You're taking this too far. I just want a little coughing fit.
Yeah.
I just want a little coughing fit. That's all I want.
Well, I think our time is about up, but I wanted to ask you, don't you have another book that's finished? You're just kind of waiting to figure out what to do with it?
Well, if what you mean by waiting to figure out what to do with it means waiting for somebody to buy it, yes.
Well, I was trying to be nice.
But no, you're being very, very kind. It's tough. A lot of things have changed in the publishing industry in the last couple of years because of the advent of e-books. And, if this was 10 years ago, this wouldn't be a question of whether or not a book of mine would get published because, my books make their money back, and I'm a good author for a house to have. But, they can't, the houses can't afford to have people like me who just sell enough copies to make your money back. So it's kind of a tough thing, and so that's the sad reality of it. And
the record industry is the same way, yeah.
Right, and what's sadder is that what's more unfortunate is this is the best thing I've written. It's called Shrink Thyself. It's about a guy who ends therapy and tries to lead a non-psychological life, and his shrink wants to remain friends, and yet his shrink turns out to be very crazy and very inappropriate, and the type of things happen that would drive anybody else into therapy, but this guy keeps walking through life, and it's I'm very proud of it. I think that it'll see the light of day some way, but maybe Everything Hurts will be a big hit and somebody will scoop it up and want to publish it. I don't know. But I just keep writing. Right now I'm thinking about doing a sequel to The Ringer, and we'll see about that. But, writers write. Writers write, and that's what I do. And if you can have enough balance, I'm there's nobody that's had more good fortune than me. I married the right girl, which I recommend, and I've been at the Letterman Show for 21 years. I write books, and I got a band, who's got it better than me?
That's all the bases covered right now.
Right. Do you ever come to New York?
Yeah, I'm in a band that's actually based in New Jersey, but I'm the only one that doesn't live there. I spend a lot of time on Amtrak, and we're based out of Highland Park, New Jersey, and we play like Castaways and places like that.
Oh, so that's right down the street from the Red Lion. It's two doors down.
Yeah. The last time when we played Kenny's Castaways, there was somebody in there, and I don't know if they were telling the truth, but they were trying to make us believe they had gotten a copy of that your brother's that album that's so rare.
Uh-huh.
And And they and I said, well, where is it? I want to see it. Oh, they said, well, I left it in the back seat of the car. So they're either
which is what you do with a valuable album.
Yeah, yeah. I would have.
Well,
liked
you know, you. Can, I'll tell you, you can Sundays, and you know Sundays. Is it Sundays that re-released? No, Arf Records re-released it on CD, and it's Calm Before.
Mm-hmm.
The Rising Storm is the name of the album. So you can get it. You
okay.
can get it.
Well,
you just can't get the vinyl.
Yeah, this guy was trying to make me believe he just happened to pick up the vinyl at Bleecker Bob's or something. And I didn't believe him, but
wow.
he paid a ticket. He wow. paid money to see us, so I didn't give him too hard of a time. But
hey, well, listen, you need to tell me when you're going to be up here. Now the Truants are playing at the Red Lion on September 13th, so that's a Thursday night. We hit the stage at 7 o'clock. I like going on early because that's when all my friends are still up. And, you know,
yeah.
when you're 55, that's when you're drawing people. But, this is the last thing I'll say. Here's the difference. When I have a book come out and I tell people that I'm doing a reading at Barnes & Noble of my novel, it's always, oh, what night is that? Is that Tuesday? Is that, oh, that's Uptown? Oh, what time is
yeah.
that? 8? Oh, what, you know. But if you tell people that you're in a band that plays the Beatles, what time and what do I need to wear? You know, it's like that. When you tell people
yeah.
you play the Beatles, they're there. Hey, God bless you. I'm so glad that you reached out to me on the email, on my email, and this has been an absolute pleasure. And anytime you want to talk, you let me know. And please let me know when you're working up
okay.
here. Because I'll come to see you. You know I will.
Well, I want to see the Truants because I think I knew every song called out.
Of course you did. Of course you did. Why wouldn't
you? It's rare to see that many of them played by one band in one
yeah.
setting. So.
Yeah. Hey, John, thanks a lot for this. You made my day.